I met Emily a few years ago at a Theology of Body conference. By this time, I had been studying Theology of Body for several years at the Theology of Body Institute in Philadelphia with Christopher West. I was struggling with how best to articulate this profound teaching, this very intense teaching, so that we could apply it to our everyday lives without needing a PhD in philosophy or theology. When I heard Emily speak, I knew that I had found the right person to get us started. She really has a great way of taking the basic principles of theology of the body and applying them to everyday life, to what it means to be human in all of our interactions. And so I am very happy that she agreed to come and speak to us tonight. Emily is a well-known Catholic writer and speaker. She has written several articles and books. She has authored a Bible study for young girls and a video series for Endow the Women's Ministry. Emily is also active on her blog and on Instagram, where she shares her thoughts on food, faith, and home renovations. I will let her tell you that story. In short, Emily shares her life with others so that we too will be encouraged to study, learn, and grow in holiness. Emily lives in Pittsburgh with her husband, Chris, who is a theology teacher at a high school there, and her baby, Toby. Please welcome Emily Stimson Chapman.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming out tonight in the cold and the dark. I grew up in northern Illinois, so I should be made of hardier stuff, but I don't leave the house after dark in the winter, so like I'm very impressed with all of you. And even if I were more reflective of my Illinois roots, we have a 15-month-old, so he now goes to bed usually at 6:30, so we're like prisoners to the tiny tyrant after 6 p.m. So you're getting a very rare Emily after dark sighting. Nobody sees me out in public after dark these days. Now, if there is anyone in this room who is thinking, isn't she a little old to have a 15-month-old? The answer depends on the day. Last Friday, when I was trying to field an important work call and simultaneously deal with his explosive diarrhea, the answer was yes. I am way too old for this, Lord. But most days, it's awesome. Becoming a mom has been a huge blessing for me at a time in life when most of my friends are, you know, well on into mothering. For those of you who don't know my story, it took God a long time to bring my husband around to marrying me. And in those years, I got to be such an expert on the single life that someone asked me to write a book about it, which was not one of my life goals. But thanks be to God, it all worked out. And 3.5 years ago, my husband Chris and I got married. We tried for 2 years to conceive, but it did not. That was not God's plan. So last July, we ended up adopting a gorgeous baby boy named Toby, who is a total joy and is going to try to make it through some of my talk, but we'll see. You might hear from him later. But we're not here to talk about adoption. We are here to talk about the theology of the body and zombies. Why, you wonder, are we going to talk about zombies? Zombies are not something you normally talk about when you go to a place called Immaculate Heart of Mary. But Karen and the organizers asked me to talk about theology of the body in everyday life, and I don't know how to do that without first talking about zombies. I will explain. I decided a few years ago that here in the modern world, in America, really in lots of places in the West, we are living in the midst of a zombie apocalypse. I came to this conclusion when I was still single and childless and had time to do things like exercise and watch TV. And one winter, I needed something new to watch on the treadmill, and people recommended I watch the AMC show, The Walking Dead. Anyone here watch it? Okay, yeah, not normally the sort of thing I would watch either. I'm not a zombie person. But some people who I trusted recommended it, so I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. I'm on the treadmill. I don't have any. Treadmills and zombies seem to go hand in hand. So the first few seasons, I was hooked. I loved it. After a few seasons, it got extra violent and extra dark, and I decided that was more than I could handle. And I know it was zombies, so dark shouldn't have been a surprise. But the first few seasons were brilliant, and what drew me into it was that the show was asking questions that went straight to the heart of the theology of the body. Questions like, who are we? How are we meant to live? And what does it mean to be human? Now, since most of you are unfamiliar with the show, I will explain. In the world of The Walking Dead, huge swaths of the population have lost their humanity to causes unknown. Nobody knows why. Maybe it was something in the water, maybe it was genetically modified food. It's a big question. All they know is that the world was just going along, doing its thing, and the next thing you know, zombie apocalypse. Now, these zombies, or as they call them on the show, walkers, they're neither fully dead nor fully alive. So they move, they eat, they gravitate towards one another, so they usually travel in packs, but they don't feel, they don't remember, they don't know who they are or see the glory of God's creation all around them. To them, every living thing, every animal, every person is just food. You know, it's something to use or consume. The show, however, isn't really about the zombies. If it were just about the zombies, I wouldn't have gotten past the first season. It's about the living. It's about the people who haven't turned into zombies. No, it's about the 1% who are struggling to retain their humanity in a world that has lost its mind. Like, is any of this sounding familiar? All right. The window dressing is different. Like, our Walking Dead have, you know, less blood on their clothing, fewer holes in their skin than the Walking Dead in, you know, in the TV show The Walking Dead. But the worlds are really the same. If you need confirmation, if you think Emily has lost her mind, just go outside, turn on the news, you know, log on to Twitter, and you will see the Walking Dead everywhere you look. They are the men and women who have broken faith with God in some serious way. They have the wounds of sin on their souls, if not on their faces. In our culture, the Walking Dead are legion. You know, so many people live in darkness. So many people have turned their backs on God and banished the life of God, which is sanctifying grace, from their souls. They have become spiritually dead, even if they're physically alive. Now, our Walking Dead, just like the Walking Dead on television, don't know who they are. You know, they don't know their dignity or their beauty. They nip, they tuck, they starve themselves in pursuit of some crazy, unrealistic ideal. They give their bodies away to the wrong people in the wrong times and the wrong ways. They worship youth, and they are scared to death of growing old. Our Walking Dead also don't know why they were created or what it means to live a fully human life. They don't see the meaning or purpose written in creation. They don't hear the heavens proclaiming the glory of God. They believe that what they own or what they do or how they look is what makes them valuable, not just who they are. Lastly, our Walking Dead do not see the dignity of the people around them. You know, just like the Walking Dead on the show, everyone around them is someone to use for pleasure or gratification or some sort of profit or gain. Or even worse, their inconveniences to be rid of through abortion, through euthanasia, or through good old-fashioned neglect. Now, our struggle, just like the struggle of the protagonists on The Walking Dead, is to not join their ranks. It is to retain our humanity in an increasingly inhuman world. It's to have mercy and compassion for the wounded and work in the midst of all of the cultural crazy to help rebuild the world. In the television show, that is almost impossibly hard because there are crazed, flesh-eating zombies everywhere. It throws wrenches into things. For us, though, it's equally, if differently, difficult. And that's because we've all grown up in the midst of the zombie apocalypse. We have been raised in it. It is our native turf. And so that means we sometimes act like zombies even when we don't realize it. And that is where the theology of the body comes in. So See, I told you I'd get around to it. All right, now for those of you who are new to the theology of the body, I know a lot of you here have read my book, These Beautiful Bones, but for those of you who haven't, the phrase theology of the body refers to a series of Wednesday audiences that Pope John Paul II gave between 1979 and 1983. So every Wednesday for 4 years, except for when he was in the hospital because he got shot, John Paul II would come out on the Wednesday on the balcony during his Wednesday audiences and deliver what we call the theology of the body piece by piece. After he was done, it all got collected into a book, and they titled it The Theology of the Body. Now, for a while, nobody paid much attention to what he had said. Some scholars did, some priests did, but most lay people looked at the Wednesday audiences and they were like, okay. John Paul II is very Polish, so he doesn't talk or write in the nice linear way that you're used to, like A to B to C. He talks cyclically, so he goes round and round and round in circles until he finally comes to a point. So that throws off a lot of Westerners when they read the audiences. And it's also, he's a brilliant theologian and philosopher, and the texts are very dense. So that can make it difficult just to sit down and read the audiences. But by the turn of the century, a lot of people did start finding ways to talk about the theology of the body in ways that made it more accessible. And that was great, but there was a problem. Because what they were focusing on is what the theology of the body had to say about human sexuality and married love. Which on one level that makes sense because the theology of the body has a lot to say about those things. A lot of really beautiful things that people need to hear. But it also confused people. People heard the phrase, the theology of the body, and automatically they're like, oh, well, that's the church's teachings on sex. And if they already agreed with the church's teachings on sex, if they felt like it didn't apply to them at that stage in their life, if they weren't interested in hearing anything more about what the church had to say, they just tuned out the theology of the body, which is a mistake. Because the theology of the body has something to say to everyone. It is for married people and single people and young people and old people. It's for religious, it's for the fertile, it's for the infertile. There's nobody the theology of the body doesn't have something to say to. And that's because at its core, the theology of the body is not a study of sex. The theology of the body is a study of what it means to be a human person made in the image of God. In other words, the theology of the body is not a sexology. Okay, it's not something that Dr. Ruth could write. It is an anthropology. It takes 2,000 years of scripture and tradition meditating on what it means to be a human person, and then it repackages that in a language that's more suited for our zombie apocalypse reared ears. One way that I often talk about theology of the body is to compare it to a pair of glasses. So me, like I, Emily, I am blind as a bat. Okay, like legally, I'm legally blind. I am literally blind. If I don't have my contacts in, the whole world is a kaleidoscope of colors to me. I can't see shapes. I can't see faces. If it weren't for modern optometry, I would be the village idiot. I'm so grateful for modern optometry. But when I put my contacts in, though, everything comes into focus. Like, all I am is just super nearsighted like a 90-year-old woman. So contacts fix my vision and allow me to see reality in front of me. Theology of the body is like that. Original sin and our own personal sins have clouded our vision more than we know. We don't see reality in front of us, and sometimes we don't even know we're not seeing it. But when we start looking at the world through the lens of the theology of the body, things come into focus. We start seeing the world as God made the world. We see the reality that God wants us to see. Like, everything becomes sharper. So, what is the reality the theology of the body shows us? We could spend hours talking about it. I wrote a whole book about it, but we have 1 hour together. So what I'm going to do for the rest of our time is first I'm going to boil down the fundamental lessons of the theology of the body into three. So three fundamental lessons. Then I'm going to give you five easy, practical ways that you can apply the theology of the body to your everyday life. So let's start with the key lessons. All right, first thing the theology of the body reminds us is that everything in creation images God. okay, or everything in creation reflects God is what I should say. The theology of the body shows us a universe that is teeming with grace, where every single thing, like every sunset, every broccoli stalk, every bluebird, the whole lot of creation in some way says something about its maker, and therefore it can be an occasion of grace because it draws us closer to our maker. If you think about a painting, you know, a painting always says something about the artist. It's done in the artist's style. A poem is written in the poet's style. God created the world in his style. So when we look at creation, we can know truths about God. You can look at a sunset and say, oh, God is beauty. You can look at a mountain and say, God is majestic. You can look at an ocean and say, God is infinite. You can look at chocolate and say, God is love. You know, there are all of these things in some way say something about God. And so they draw us closer to him and help us adore him. In that, the theology of the body reminds us that matter, like the stuff of the material world, matters. Bodies and bread and oil and water, all of it helps us to know God better. It helps us to know ourselves better. It helps us to know each other better. Matter is not bad. Matter is not evil. Matter is good. And it's part of the story of our salvation. All right, so that's the first fundamental lesson. Matter matters because it reflects the Creator. Second, the theology of the body tells us that our bodies are not something apart from the real us. Okay, they are not husks. They are not carrying cases for our soul like we have carrying cases for our iPhones. Our bodies are us. So my body is me. Your body is you. As human beings, we are a perfect union of body and soul. The two always go together. So the soul animates the body. It gives it life. If we don't have a soul in our body, we're just a rotting hunk of flesh. Like, we're not a living person. But at the same time, you know, without our body, our soul can't be known. Who we are, what we love, what we feel can't be made visible in the world. So the two always work together. In practical terms, that means that people know you are happy when you smile. They know you are sad when you cry. They know you're angry when your face gets red and your eyes get squinty. They know you're in love if you're walking hand in hand with your spouse or your boyfriend or your girlfriend. But our bodies don't just reveal our emotions. Our bodies tell the story of us to the world. They show people who we are in terms of how we've struggled, how we've loved, how we've suffered. They're books that explain us to the people who see us. Now, you don't always recognize this when you're young because you're like an unwritten page and everything is nice. But at 44, I can tell you that my body is becoming one big book of me. Every gray hair I have, I got during the adoption process of our son. Not a single gray hair before then. On my abdomen are the scars from 5 different surgeries. One that was done to save my life, and 4 that were done to help us try to conceive life. I have lots of laugh lines, and I like my laugh lines. I say they are my favorite tattoos, because they say more about how I lived my life than any ink could. I'm not as fond about my forehead wrinkles, which appeared during our renovation of our house. I'm like, go away, I want to erase that chapter of my life. And my hands, my hands are scarred up, they're so not pretty, but it's because I love to cook, and I'm also not very methodical. I tend to rush through things, so lots of knife marks and stitches and things like that. But I love that. I love looking at my hands because they're part of the story of me. My whole body is part of the story of me. My soul has been writing itself on my body so that I look more like myself than I did 20 years ago, not less. The same holds true for all of us. You know, all of us, in one way or another, our souls are writing our bodies. But it works the opposite way, too. Our bodies write themselves on our souls. Because of the union of body and soul, what we do in the body has a profound consequence for the soul. So if I use my body to do evil, like if I run up to you and I punch you in the face, I am hurting I'm probably not hurting your face, I'm probably hurting my hand, if we're being honest. I'm hurting my hand, but I'm also hurting my soul because I'm doing something wrong with my body. Opposite also is true. If I see you slip on the ice outside and I run up to rescue you and lift you up off the ice, I'm helping you, but my body is doing something to help my soul. It's helping it to grow in virtues and become more the Emily God made it to be. All right, that is the second truth of the theology of the body, that the body expresses the person. The third truth is that the body expresses God. So just like the stars and the seas and the mountains and the plains tell us something about God, so too does the human body. Except that's really understating it, because more than the stars and the skies and the mountains and the plains, the human body is a witness to God. Creation, it's the difference between a painting made by the artist and a son had by the artist. We image God. Like, foundational truths about who he is are in every fiber and bone in our body. More specifically, in our body's ability to love and serve and create, to give itself to another and bring forth life in the world, the body reveals a God who is love, who did serve, and who is the creator. Our bodies reveal a God who is life-giving love. We don't believe as Catholics in a lonely God. Okay, we don't think God was just hanging out there in eternity all by himself and got really bored, so he thought he would create humanity for dinner and a show kind of entertainment. That is not God. We believe in a God who is three persons, who is a holy trinity of Father and Son and Holy Spirit. And that holy trinity is always giving of themselves to each other and always receiving of themselves to each other. It's this eternal communion of self-gift. On Trinity Sunday, when we all get the homilies about the Trinity, my nickname for it is Material Heresy Sunday. Because, like, it's almost impossible to talk about the Trinity without saying something wrong. Like, the Trinity is the most amazing mystery in the entire universe. There is no way we can ever put all of the truths about the Trinity into a homily or, you know, 1 minute in a talk. But the easiest way to understand the Trinity that I think contains no material heresy is that the Trinity is the Father eternally giving of himself to the Son. He is pouring out everything he is, everything he has. He is making a total gift of himself to the Son. The Son is receiving everything the Father has to give. He's receiving it all, and then he's giving it right back. He is making a gift of himself to the Father. And the self-gift between them, this exchange of love and life, is so real, it's so complete, that it is a person. It is the Holy Spirit. So that is the Holy Trinity. He is a life-giving communion of love. But he doesn't just contain the love within himself. That love pours out into every corner of the universe, touching us, and then God calls us into that communion. He wants us to be a part of that eternal exchange of love. So here in this life, the way he helps us be part of that exchange is by calling us to be gifts to one another. Each of us is called to do, to the extent that a human can, what God does. We are called to pour out our life and our love and make a gift of each other, and we're called to receive the gifts of others in return. So, this can sound complicated, and eyes are always glazing over when I talk about the Trinity. My eyes are glazing over when I talk about the Trinity. It's tired. It's my bedtime. So, Trinity is hard at 9 o'clock at night. 9 in the morning, it's easier to talk about the Trinity. All right, so as complicated as this all can sound sometimes, like, we're called to image this God who is pure, life-giving love. How on earth do we do that? It's actually not that complicated. Theologians can make it sound complicated, but it isn't. And my guess is you're already doing a lot of the things that it takes to live the theology of the body in everyday life. So that is what we're going to talk about now. 5 practical things you can do. And it starts with turning your phone off. I know, this is like asking a 2-year-old to give up their binky, and I am one of those 2-year-olds, okay? Like, this is hard for me. I have a 15-month-old at home. I am an extrovert, and oftentimes the only other adult besides my husband I see in the day are Miss Jackie and Miss Nancy, who are the crossing guards on our corner that I see when we go out on the walk. And I think Miss Jackie and Miss Nancy think I'm crazy, because I'm always so happy to talk to them and see what's going on. I'm like, you don't understand, you're the only other adult I'm going to see for hours. So in that context, my phone is very important to me. It is my connection to the outside world. But I also know that living the theology of the body means that I have got to log off of Instagram and turn the phone off and pay attention to my baby. Back to the zombies that we talked about at the beginning. They're really bad at seeing the world around them. You know, they just kind of stumble around with a glazed look on their eye until food comes into view. Even if you have never seen the show, I know you know what this looks like because you have seen it at the grocery store or at the coffee shop or at your kitchen table, you know, where people's faces are so glued to their phone that they're missing everything going on around them. This is a problem. I can tell you how much of a problem it was for me once. A few years ago, when I still lived in Steubenville, I'm a writer, so I work from home, but I had a holy hour during the middle of the day. So I left home and was heading off to the holy hour, got there, and the Adoration Chapel was in the basement. So I was racing because I was late, because work day, it's hard to get away. So I was racing to get to the chapel. But of course I had to check my email because God forbid, 15 minutes have gone by since I've checked my email. And I was so focused on my phone that I missed the life-size marble statue of Jesus that was right in front of me. Technically, it wasn't the whole statue. It was his hand. It was extended like this. And I ran smack dab, full-on power walking pace into Jesus' hand. I hit his hand so hard with my head, okay, with my head, that his marble fingers went flying across the basement floor. I got knocked to the ground. Normally when I get hurt, I swear because I don't like to cry in front of people, but I was outside the Adoration Chapel, so I couldn't swear. So I burst into tears, and everyone comes running out, and they're like, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Jesus smacked me upside the head." They're like, "Oh, she must be really bad." I was like, no, you don't understand. No, I had a concussion. I couldn't write for weeks. I had to explain to every single person I couldn't write for, "Jesus hit me, so I can't." All right. Most of you, hopefully, will not have to deal with a violent God because of your phone tendencies, all right? It's a special kind of love Jesus reserved for me and the Israelites. But if you do not put your phone down, he will slap you somehow, okay? There is this busy, beautiful, bustling world all around us, but so often we miss it because we have our faces stuck in our phones. You know, we've got to check Instagram or Twitter or I don't know what sports team you guys follow up here, but for my husband, it's everything Pittsburgh. But when we are looking at our phones and not at the person who is in front of us, we are speaking a language of the body. Our body is saying something. What we are saying is that what is happening in the virtual world is more important to me than what's happening in the real world. Like, we are telling the person that we are with that you and this conversation is less interesting to me than what's happening on Instagram. We are also missing opportunities. If you are on your phone when you're in the line at the grocery store, you don't have a chance to smile at the checker and ask her how her day was. And, you know, in this culture, that might be the only smile that she gets. If you are on your phone on the bus or on the plane, you might miss that there's a person who is desperately lonely sitting next to you who just needs somebody to listen to them for 5 minutes. The phone keeps us from seeing the value and the dignity and the needs of the people around us. It also keeps us from missing out on really important moments. I love Instagram. Those of you who follow me on Instagram know I love Instagram. But there's no post on Instagram about my baby that's ever going to be as important as my baby. There is nothing I'm going to write on Facebook that is going to make a difference in the world like it will for me to read a story to my child, or listen to my husband, or say a prayer for a friend in need. Just think for a minute about John Paul II. You know how people always say that in the 5 minutes or 30 seconds or however long they were with them, they felt like they were the most important person in the world? That's because his attention was completely on them. Like, for however long he was talking to them, that person was the focus of their world. John Paul II would not be walking around the Vatican with his face in a phone, ignoring, like, all of the Swiss guards and the nuns bustling around him. He just wouldn't do it. He understood that the theology of the body calls us to be present. It calls us to live in the real world and prioritize it over the virtual world and just see the dignity of the person in front of us. C.S. Lewis said that next to the Eucharist, the holiest thing you will ever see is your neighbor. John Paul II understood that. He lived it, and he's calling us to live it too. All right, so that is the first way to live the theology of the body in everyday life. Second, super simple, hold the door for someone. If you want to honor someone as a gift, or as John Paul II would say, welcome the gift of the other, here are a few tips for what you should not do. Slam a door in a person's face, drive 90 miles an hour in a 60-mile-an-hour zone and pass somebody on the right. Michigan people, you do that a lot. My best friend lives in Michigan. I'm very familiar with Michigan drivers. Every traffic reference here is pretty much a reference to Michigan drivers. You also could tell someone online who disagrees with you exactly what you think about their mother. You could ignore a dinner invitation until the last minute because you're waiting for something better to show up. You get all huffy with the AT&T operator who has no responsibility whatsoever for the fact that your internet is down again. Or you could just steal a parking space from somebody and when they honk at you, flip them the bird. All of those behaviors are part of a zombie culture, and we see them every day. Like, they are part of a culture that focuses on me, myself, and I, that doesn't recognize people as gifts or seek to honor them as such, and that doesn't realize that being the image of God means that we are the face of Christ in the world. In this culture, it is so easy to be rude. You know, it is easy to be thoughtless and late and self-absorbed because we're all so busy and everyone's racing from one place to the other, and rudeness is almost the expectation. But when we do that, you know, we are not seeing Christ in front of us. We are not seeing the image of God in front of us. We are doing the same thing when we disagree with someone online and we feel free to unleash all of our anger on them and tell them exactly what we think of them and what they do, and even try to destroy their livelihood just because they don't agree with us. Every time you see that kind of doxing online, that is a zombie culture. But if we want to live the theology of the body, like really, really, really live it, then we have to make sure that we're loving everybody, even the people in Michigan who cut us off in traffic, or vote for someone who we think is evil. We don't have to agree with people. We don't have to hide our own beliefs or opinions. We don't have to keep our opinions to ourselves. We just have to say them nicely, with kindness and respect and using just good old-fashioned manners. So not like crooking your pinky and acting like you're on Downton Abbey, but just being polite and saying things that are helpful and turning the other cheek and bearing wrongs patiently. You know, these are all little actions of the theology of the body. But when we do them, we are showing people that they matter, that they have a dignity that surpasses their wildest imagination, and that even when they're acting contrary to that dignity, they still are the image of God. Like, nothing they can do can make them less the image of God. So just try your best to be polite on the road. There's these wonderful traffic laws that help us all be kind to each other. Walk away from pointless Facebook arguments that are going nowhere, like every Facebook argument since the beginning of time. If someone cuts you off, say a prayer for them. If someone steals your parking space, ask your guardian angel to bless them and find you another. Be really old-fashioned and hold the door for someone with a stroller, or offer your seat to somebody who looks like they might need to sit down. Or if you see a young mom struggling to get like 10-pound gallons of joint compound into her car, offer to help her. Like, believe me, I would have liked those offers a lot. Just do your best to look at people and treat them as the image of God, and you will be living the theology of the body. All right. Third way to live the theology of the body in everyday life, be nice to your body. Your body is a gift. It doesn't matter if you think it is too tall or too short, too thin or too fat. It doesn't matter if you have stretch marks or wrinkles or can't run as fast as you used to. It doesn't matter if you can't run at all anymore. It is still a gift. Like, it is what allows you to love and be loved, to know others and be known by others. And so it needs to be treated with kindness and respect. As some of you know, I did not always see my body this way. For 6 years, I struggled with anorexia and other eating disorders. I hated my body. You know, I thought my body was a problem. It was something that needed to be controlled. So I needed to control its shape and its size and what went into it and what it desired. It was this thing I had to wrestle into submission. And then one day, I read The Theology of the Body, and I realized that my body is not a problem to be controlled. My body is a gift to be cared for. So I want to stop for a minute just to think about that distinction between control and care. Control is about power, right? It's about managing a problem. It's about somehow wrestling an issue into submission so that it's doing it exactly how we want it to do. Care, on the other hand, is about love. It seeks to honor a good. So we care for the gifts people give us. Controlling the body, caring for the body are two entirely different things. One treats the body like a problem, the other treats the body like a gift. The world we live in tells us that our bodies are problems. They're weak, they suffer, they get sick, they grow old, they die. When you see the body that way, when you see it as a problem, the most natural response in the world is to try to stop all of those things or at least slow them down. So avoiding suffering, slowing down aging, and, you know, running from death because you don't know what to do with it because nobody can get out of that. But that's not what the theology of the body tells us. Like, that's not what our Catholic faith tells us. They tell us that our bodies aren't problems, they are us. And they are great gifts from a good and loving God. And he did not give us those gifts so we can look hot in a bikini or really good in a pair of jeans. Like, that is not why God has been handing out bodies since the beginning of time. God gave me a body so I can be me. He gave you a body so he can be you, so you can be you. Like, he gave us bodies so we can be who he made us to be, so we can do the cooking or the cleaning or the building or the painting or the garden growing or the bookshelf building, whatever it is we love to do, that's why we have these bodies, so we can express who we are. Everything you love, there is nothing you love to do that you can't do without your body. Even like sleep is my biggest goal in life right now that's always frustrated. I'm like, oh, I used to want to cook and now I just want to sleep. I couldn't do it without my body. God also gave us these bodies so we can love and serve others, so that we can cook for our friends and take care of our aging parents. So we can babysit the neighbor kids or grandkids or go down to the homeless shelter and spend time with the people there. He gave us bodies so that we can hug our spouses and rock our babies to sleep at night and kiss their boo-boos and pour love into them with our body. God also gave us bodies so that we can appreciate the splendor of his creation, you know, so we can see him in the sky and the sun and the rain and look everywhere around us and see something reflecting the glory of God. God gave us our bodies so we can worship him, you know, so we can kneel in his presence, so we can sing his praises and speak his holy name, and most of all, so we can receive his body into our bodies. Lastly, God gave us our bodies so that somehow, mysteriously, imperfectly, we can make him known in this world. So that as we suffer and sacrifice and serve and love and nurture and nourish those around us, we are imaging a God who suffered and sacrificed for us, who loves us and serves us and nurtures us and nourishes us. And what do you do with a gift like that? You certainly don't measure its value with numbers on a scale. You don't spend hours every day at the gym trying to mold it and manipulate it into a shape that it's naturally not. You don't starve it. You don't overindulge it. You don't fill it with dangerous toxic chemicals like meth or opioids. You don't neglect the body. You don't refuse to rest it. You don't treat it with disgust. You don't treat the body like a problem. Instead, you care for it. You feed it right, and you move it often enough so that it can do all of the loving and serving God is calling it to do. You give it rest and sleep so that it can recover from a hard day's work. You go outside, and you feel the sun on your face and the wind in your hair, and, you know, you hear the snow crunching in November, which is super cheerful. You can take it to Mass. You can put it in front of Jesus, and most of all, with a gift like that, you give thanks for it. Like, you give thanks for every step it takes, every good action it performs. You praise the Lord and you glorify him in your body by letting your body do what it was supposed to do. So basically, you don't treat it like it's a demon to be combated or a god to be worshipped. You treat it like a temple. You treat it like a holy place to be cared for. Now, does this mean you are never going to struggle with your body and be frustrated with what it can't do or how it looks? No. Okay, I am frustrated plenty with my body's refusal to bear a baby. I am not super fond of the fact that all the fertility drugs I've been on over the past few years have added 10 pounds to my physique. But when I start to lament the loss of half of my wardrobe, I have really pretty things I can't wear anymore. That is a little bit hard. I just try to think about all the beautiful things my body is doing now that it's never done before. You know, how it is pouring love into my little baby. And I always say it's his favorite bed. You know, Toby likes to sleep nowhere but my body has become a bed. But that's beautiful because it makes love incarnate for my son. My son thinks my body is beautiful because it's his home. My husband thinks my body is beautiful because I have entrusted it to him as a gift and because I love him with it and comfort him with it and feed him with it. And, you know, compared to all of that, like, what's a couple dresses? When you are struggling with your body, try to do something similar. Like, just think about all that your body can do or all that your body has ever done. Like, every act of love, every act of service, every meal you've cooked, every room you've cleaned, every baby you've hugged, every parent you've kissed. Like, think about all of that and then give thanks for it. And if you do that, you are living the theology of the body. All right, fourth way to live the theology of the body in everyday life, talk to the homeless guy downtown. While you're at it, ask him his name, tell him yours, find out his story, maybe buy him a sandwich. You know, do this even when it's inconvenient. Actually, do it when it's inconvenient, because the more inconvenient it is, the more you're making a gift of self to him, the more you are serving him through an embodied act of love. And I know life is busy. Like, I'm a full-time mom and a full-time writer, and, you know, showering has become a great luxury. But still, you know, every once in a while, once a month, every other month, find a way to go visit the elderly neighbor whose kids live far away, or someone who's in the nursing home who has no one else to visit them. Gather up coats and take them to the homeless shelter, or just stand outside of Planned Parenthood on a Saturday morning and pray for all of the terrified women who are going in there. When you do those things, when you make a gift of your time and attention to the homeless, to the lonely, to the needy, to the terrified, like, you are performing a corporal work of mercy. And a corporal work of mercy is an embodied act of love, and it is a way of living the theology of the body. So is friendship. You know, it's not just the lonely and the homeless we need to talk to, it's also our friends. And, like, really talk to them. Don't just like something on Facebook or send them a text, but actually call them up and talk to them. Like, you know how phones have this neat thing where if you push numbers, you can hear the voice on the other end? Like, it's totally old-fashioned, but it really works sometimes. Even if you don't want to call them, you can send them a text and invite them over for dinner. Like, it doesn't matter if the house is messy. It doesn't matter if the kids are crazy. People are lonely, and they need to be in each other's company, like, in the body. Friendship is meant to be embodied. Service is meant to be embodied. Love is meant to be embodied. Like, God did not give us bodies just so that we can look at screens and type on keyboards. God gave us eyes so that we can look into other people's eyes. He gave us ears so we can hear what people have to say. He gave us hands so we can touch them and hug them. Like, Jesus did not save us by texting the gospel. He could have. Like, you laugh, but he could have. He could have waited 2,000 years till technology caught up, and we all could have been getting texts from God. Like, isn't there a TV show like that or something? Like, God friended me. He could have done that, but he didn't. Jesus came to be with us in the flesh. He showed us what it means to love people by doing it with his body. Like, he talked with us, and he walked with us, and he ate with us, and he touched us, and he offered his body on the cross for us. And loving people with our bodies is exactly what he's calling us to do. And that brings us to the fifth and last way to live the theology of the body in everyday life. Say yes to suffering. This is the no fun way to live the theology of the body in everyday life, but the more time that has passed in my life, the more I've realized this is the most important way we live the theology of the body. Jesus said yes to suffering for us. Like, this is how he saved us. He offered his body on the cross for us. He gave himself as an atoning sacrifice and secured our redemption through that offering. Because of what he did on the cross, we have a way out of the zombie apocalypse, okay? We don't have to live in the darkness forever. But Jesus' offering did something else. When he offered himself on the cross, it made it possible for our suffering to be redemptive too. We are, St. Paul tells us, Jesus' co-workers. We complete what is lacking in the suffering of Christ for the sake of his body, which is the church. Whenever I repeat that verse from Colossians, I feel a little bit crazy, because how can anything be lacking in the suffering of Christ, right? Like, he is God. He gave everything for us. But Jesus wants us to be participants in our redemption and in the redemption of others. And so he calls us to follow him to the cross. And when we get there, we have a choice. We can say yes or we can say no. We can say, yes, Jesus, I will suffer with you. Yes, Jesus, I trust you. Yes, Jesus, I love you. Take my suffering and do something beautiful with it. Or we can say no. We can say, no, Jesus, I will not suffer with you. No, Jesus, I do not trust you. No, Jesus, I will not offer this to you. I will hate it and resent it, and I will hate you for allowing this to happen to me. Every single one of us in this room is, or will, or has carried a cross of crushing proportions. You know, like, job loss and death and sickness and loneliness and failure, it comes for every single one of us at some point. And when it comes, we have to decide, will we say no or will we say yes? If we say no, we will still suffer. Like, you're not getting out of it no matter what you say. But we will grow bitter and hard and envious in our suffering. We will resent it. And that resentment, that no, will eat away at our soul and it will destroy us. Like, we will become like the zombies, just stumbling around in pain and hurting everybody who gets in our way. If we say yes, again, we will still suffer. You're not getting out of it. But our suffering will conform our heart to Christ's. Our heart will grow in love for Christ. It will grow in love for others. And the more we plant ourselves on Calvary, the more we cling to Christ and bury our faces in his bloody, pierced feet, the more our suffering will be transformed and it will become a gift. And I know this because this has been the past 3 years of my life. Infertility is the heaviest cross I have ever carried. My body has been cut open 4 times to try to heal it. My heart has been broken open with every single negative pregnancy test and every pregnancy announcement on Facebook that I know I'm never going to get to make. My heart breaks for the babies I won't have. Like, all I ever wanted in life was to be a mom of a large family. I'm really glad I'm here with you guys tonight, but I didn't want this. Okay, I didn't want to write books. I didn't want to give talks. I wanted 7 kids and a 15-passenger van and a homeschool room. Like, if you have that, you are living my dream. But I didn't get that life. God gave me a different life. And at first, as I had to reconcile with that, it was hard. Like, it hurt. But I kept saying yes. I kept looking at the cross, like literally looking at the cross. I have a crucifix or a picture of the suffering Christ in every room in my house because I need to see Jesus suffering for me so that I can say yes to suffering for him. And so I kept saying yes, and because I didn't let go, 2 things happened. First, I fell more in love with Jesus than I ever imagined I would. He softened my heart, and he gentled it and transformed it. And my faith today is a very different faith than it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago when I wrote These Beautiful Bones or 7 years ago. I loved Jesus then, but I didn't love him the way I do now. He didn't matter to me the way he matters to me now. I was not willing to make as much of a fool of myself then as I'm willing to make of myself now for him. So that was the first thing. The second thing is that he transformed the cross of infertility into a blessing for me. Because without infertility, we never would have been led to our son. Without infertility, without all those negative pregnancy tests, we wouldn't have Toby, who is this amazing destroyer of all things and climbing everywhere. And when he wants to kiss me right now, he takes his fist and he grabs my hair with both hands and he pulls his face to him. And like, he's such a boy. Like, the boy love is violent, man. but it's so beautiful. It's wonderful. But God used my suffering to break open my heart so that it was big enough to welcome our beautiful little boy. He took my yes to the cross and he turned it into an even bigger blessing. And that is what he does with every single yes. So when you suffer, as you suffer, say yes. You know, make a gift of your heart and your pain to him and let the miracle of grace that he accomplished on Calvary become a miracle of grace in your life, transforming every tear into a blessing that is somehow going to bring about your redemption and the redemption of the world. There is no greater gift of yourself than you can make than to suffer with Christ, because that's what Christ did for us. And so when we suffer with him, when we say yes, we are imaging God in the clearest way we can image him in this life. So, there you have it. 5 ways to live the theology of the body in everyday life. 4 are sort of easy, and 1 is a lot harder. But you can turn off your phone, you can be kind to others, you can be kind to your body, serve others, and say yes to suffering. Some of these things are going to come more easily and naturally for some of you. Some are going to come harder. The phone thing is really, really hard for me right now. I'm going to get an Apple Watch because then I can leave my phone in another room and I can't be checking Instagram. That's the point I've gotten to. So figure out what you need to do it and do it. The goal of living the theology of the body in everyday life is not for us to become clones of one another, okay? We're not looking to all become Catholic Stepford men and women who are going around, you know, driving our 15-passenger vans. Although, again, if you have one, I'm super jealous. the goal is to become ourselves. You know, it's to become who God made us to be and live lives that are authentically human, that show everyone else living in the zombie culture the face of Christ, the face that is always loving, that is always merciful, that is always compassionate, and that is always attentive. That is a life where we're really being who we were called to be, and that is a life that people in this culture need us to live. I can joke about zombies, but the lives of people in our culture who are lost and struggling and confused, it's not funny. No, it's not a joke. They desperately need to see the face of Christ. And if you don't show them that face, they are not going to see it. So for yourself, for them, let God enter into every corner of your life and transform it so that you are living exactly the life he calls you to live. And I am going to pray for you guys. And if you could say a prayer for me, and we will all try to not be zombies together. So let's close with the Hail Mary, and then I think we're good. So, in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.